Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Saturday, April 13th, day 190 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel Dan here with our U.S. Bureau Chief, Jacob Magid. Hi, Jacob. Thanks as ever for joining me on Shabbat.
Shabbat shalom, Amanda.
Shabbat shalom. Even as Israel is braced for an attack from Iran, Jewish settlers are rioting in the West Bank after an Israeli teen was murdered. Jacob will fill us in on what's going on the ground. We'll hear about Biden's stark warnings to the Iranian, as well as an attack on an Israeli-linked ship this morning. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
The Israeli Defense Forces today found the body of a 14-year-old Jerusalem resident, Benjamin Achimayir, who went missing while shepherding in the West Bank northeast of Ramallah yesterday. Achimayir was murdered in a terror attack, the IDF and Shin Bet security agency have said in a joint statement, and clashes were reported between settlers and Palestinians both yesterday and today, leaving at least one Palestinian dead, and I understand some 10 Palestinian villages are or were under attack. So, Jacob, give us a fuller picture of what's going on the ground.
Sure. So it started Friday morning, Friday afternoon, when settlers from the outpost, legal outpost of Malachi HaShalom, which is located roughly about 15 miles northeast of Ramallah, someone wants to understand where on a map, basically reported that Benjamin Achimayir was missing. He had been living on this illegal outpost, originally from Jerusalem, but basically been living out there. This teenager helping shepherd, which is often used as a tactic by a lot of these residents of the illegal outpost to try to take over as much land as possible and prevent Palestinians from getting onto more land. So he was shepherding, did not return after Friday morning, Friday afternoon, and the IDF launched this manhunt for him. And ended up, during that time, there were clashes that broke out. Settlers helping, trying to look ostensibly for Achimayir, went into the nearby village of Al-Mughayr, Palestinian village, and ransacked the place. Shots were fired once, apparently right after the IDF arrived at the scene. It's unclear who opened fire, but a Palestinian was killed, 26-year-old. And the manhunt continued until Saturday afternoon, where, unfortunately, the body of Achimayir was found nearby the outpost and nearby the village. And the IDF, as you said, is determined that this was likely a terror attack by Palestinians. And ever since, and even before, in the hours before, we saw just settlers from a lot of these young settlers from illegal outposts just ransacking through different villages in the area, honestly, all throughout the West Bank, almost a dozen villages targeted, opened fire. A lot of them are armed. Some of them are in half IDF uniforms. Some of them in full IDF uniforms, according to witness accounts. They even assaulted an Israeli photographer for the Yediot Ahronot news site, who was on scene to try to take pictures in Al-Mughayr. Broke his fingers. He tried to plead with them, saying, "I'm Jewish, I'm not Arab." They said, "We don't even care. You're documenting something that you shouldn't be seeing," and took his camera, burned his bag full of camera equipment. So a lot of just gross violence and unclear where the IDF has been throughout this as this was all happening. Certain villages have reported that the IDF arrived at the scene to try to break up some of these clashes that broke out, but definitely quite late in the game. And a lot of this violence is continuously being reported throughout Saturday afternoon and into the Saturday evening. The IDF has reportedly also, along with the border police, dispatched additional troops to the area to try to calm the situation. But when you do that, obviously, the IDF is ostensibly pretty stretched a little bit thin right now, given we have a war in Gaza, even though we don't have a ton of troops there right now. But there's plenty of force posturing on the Lebanon border. There was, unfortunately, someone that was killed in a Hezbollah drone strike, some sort of explosive device that exploded and seriously wounded, didn't kill one of the members of the security team on the northern border. So its forces are stretched thin, and the IDF is forced to call in additional troops to the West Bank because settler violence is proceeding at a rampant pace. So hopefully they'll be able to get the situation under control in the coming hours.
No one can forget the settler violence in Huwara about a year and a half ago, if I'm not mistaken. How would you compare what's happening today with what happened then, which was so bloody and so destructive?
It looks like the scope of it in terms of the amount of people in these different villages is not as wide, but the fact that it's happening in a dozen of them is quite stark. And I don't think we saw that kind of level in terms of everywhere throughout the West Bank happening all at once like it did then. But the lack of IDF presence at some of these scenes is also noteworthy. But we'll have to see it once the day ends what the real state of play is going on right now, because a lot of things are still in flux.
And indeed, it is Shabbat, and it's quite possible that things could get worse before they get better as more and more people find out about what's going on.
Right. And then you mentioned Shabbat, which reminded me about how Prime Minister Netanyahu, his spokesperson, issued a statement expressing condolences for the killing of this 14-year-old Israeli teen, which was noteworthy because right afterwards, the spokesman deleted that statement because Netanyahu, even though he's not Shomer Shabbat himself, tries to put up this persona, or I think maybe also just a degree of respect for his Orthodox coalition partners. He doesn't issue statements on Shabbat. But he does decide to do it, or at least for initially, when it's part of the constituents that he needs the backing of, which is some of these settlers in the West Bank. But last week, when the body of Elad Katsir was found and pulled out from IDF by IDF troops in Gaza and rescued and brought back after being held in captivity, there was no statement. And I think that's really been blood boiling for a lot of the hostage families who feel like Netanyahu is picking and choosing which populations he chooses to care about and weigh in on, and others which he doesn't.
So Ramadan, the holy month in the Muslim calendar, is now over. And initially, there were a lot of fears, both from the Israelis and mostly, I think, from the Americans, that it could boil over into something, well, like this. So what did happen during Ramadan?
Yeah, so a lot of concern. There was Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh calling on Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem to march toward Al-Aqsa. And Biden was worried that if we don't get a ceasefire by Ramadan, we're going to have violence in Jerusalem, which could bubble over throughout the entire region. But we didn't see that in the end. The month ended this week. The holy month of Ramadan ended this week without any major incidents. We saw over 100,000 Palestinians on average going to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Temple Mount compound, every Friday for the past 4 weeks without any major incidents. And I spoke with some officials, Israeli officials, U.S. officials, and some analysts to get an understanding of why this was. And I got basically three different reasons that I thought were pretty interesting. One was the most important. Palestinians just ostensibly didn't want to engage in violence. This was the case even before Ramadan started in Jerusalem, Jerusalem was relatively quiet throughout the whole month, which is quite noteworthy, I think, given a lot of civil society groups who were working on this behind the scenes to keep things calm. Many Palestinians stayed away from the Temple Mount compound for much of the war until Ramadan. This is unlike during the May 2021 Gaza war, where we saw buses of tens of thousands of Palestinians being sent to the Temple Mount. I think there was a lot of understanding that people were being incited by Hamas to try to spark tensions and clashes on the Mount, which is what happened then, but did not happen this time. We did obviously see an uptick of Palestinians at the Temple Mount during the Ramadan month, but nothing out of the ordinary for the most part. There might have been a lot of sympathy for Hamas, according to one Israeli official I spoke with, an Israeli security official, but he said that this didn't translate to active support. And that's a pretty big difference between the two, sympathy and active support. He said that just there's a feeling that the Palestinians identify with the Hamas struggle, but they don't really see, because I think he said they don't really see what happened on October 7th. Al Jazeera doesn't play or denies a lot of those kinds of the atrocities that were committed, but they still do see the price that the Palestinians are paying in Gaza, and they don't want to be paying that themselves, and I think chose to act accordingly, according to this Israeli security official. Second reason that was mentioned was Ben-Gvir. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister who's in charge of police, he was calling initially before Ramadan to block Arab Israelis from reaching the Temple Mount, and as well as, of course, West Bank Palestinians, but it was noteworthy that also citizens of Israel were going to be barred from prayer at an Israeli holy site. Initially, there was Netanyahu waffled about what to do with Ben-Gvir's recommendations, and his office leaked that he was considering accepting them, probably in a nod of legitimacy to Ben-Gvir. But there was then major pressure from the U.S. with Biden officials leaning on Benny Gantz in the War Cabinet to try to convince Netanyahu and the other members not to allow or accept Ben-Gvir's recommendations. But ultimately, they had to rely on security officials, the security agencies of Shin Bet and the IDF, who were better at convincing, apparently, the rest of the War Cabinet to heed their concerns, which is what ultimately happened. And Bibi agreed to basically keep the same measures that had been in place in previous years, which is noteworthy given the wartime. But this meant no Jewish or non-Muslim worshippers or non-Muslim visitors to the Temple Mount during the end days of Ramadan, as has happened in years past. They were also helped out by the fact that Ramadan didn't happen to coincide with Passover, which is not for a couple more weeks. And that meant fewer Jewish visitors, worshippers to the Temple Mount. So at the same time, the earlier this week, we had the government approve the transfer of this building enforcement body that is responsible for demolishing homes throughout Israel, East Jerusalem, and in Arab villages, as well as the most prevalent places where they're demolishing homes, because these places don't have lots of permits to build and they build illegally. And I asked this Israeli security official, is there a quid pro quo going on here between Netanyahu agreeing to give this body transfer the body to Ben-Gvir's ministry to put him in charge of these demolitions in exchange for Ben-Gvir kind of staying quiet, not going on the Temple Mount as he has in the past, and not blocking efforts in terms of police enforcement that the government wanted to see. And the official basically hinted that this was kind of the case. I asked both offices, Ben-Gvir's and Netanyahu's, for comment on this. They both, one of them just didn't comment and the other didn't deny, but said, we're not going to respond. So that was the situation with Ben-Gvir. And then the third one that I thought was interesting, third point of why things might have been calm, is this this issue of Jordan. We saw sermons on the Temple Mount at Al-Aqsa over the past month were very intense, very critical of Israel, as is often the case, but not incendiary, according to an Israeli security official. And this was because the Waqf, the Islamic Trust that is kind of administering the site, is backed by Jordan. Basically, Jordan funds and is responsible for this Waqf, and they were very much keeping in line those giving speeches, those acting, and anything that was going on in the Temple Mount, and making sure that things were calm and didn't get out of hand. And another Israeli official noted that Jordan didn't issue any fiery statements criticizing Israel, as they often do throughout this war. That didn't really happen as much during Ramadan. And I think that this official said this had to do with fears in Jordan that there are these massive protests happening that are backed by the Muslim Brotherhood, which is another wing or a sister organization of Hamas. And they're concerned about these protests growing larger, of Hamas's influence in Jordan sparking unrest. And they didn't want to see that happen through unrest in Jerusalem that would further fan the flames at home. And I think that's why Jordan took steps to try to keep things calm. So as a result, we had, surprisingly, given the fact that we're in a very bloody war in Gaza, calm in Jerusalem, despite concerns.
We'll get to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, blankie.
their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel's Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Commandos from Iran's paramilitary Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps rappelled down from a helicopter onto an Israeli-affiliated container ship near the Strait of Hormuz and seized the vessel this morning. Now, one can only assume that this is not the threatened hit on Israeli soil in retaliation of an alleged Israeli airstrike in Syria that killed several IRGC officers. So what is the U.S. security assessment in the meantime, and how has President Joe Biden responded?
So Biden responded on Friday by saying before this happened, he hasn't commented, and no U.S. officials have commented on this latest seizure of this ship. But basically on Friday, he said that he expects some sort of attack to happen in the coming, sooner rather than later, is what he said. He didn't get more specific than that, not wanting to disclose intelligence. But he also said that the U.S. has Israel's back and that will continue defending, helping Israel secure itself and defend itself from Iranian attacks, and reissued his warning that he made on days after October 7th to Iran and any adversaries of Israel looking to join Hamas in the fight, which was one word, don't. He said the same thing again on Friday, and I think that's the U.S. message, despite the tensions that we're seeing between Biden and Netanyahu. The principled support that the U.S. has provided Israel seems to be maintained throughout these tensions. We saw some sort of boosting in the U.S. force posture in the region. There were reports of the USS Dwight Eisenhower being dispatched further north up the Red Sea toward Israel to provide the ability to intercept any sort of missiles or rockets that are launched from Iran at Israel. But the fact that, I mean, we don't know, there's a lot of assumption that there's going to be some massive attack. There are all these different reports about 20 at once, different military targets in Israel and abroad. But it's possible that the kinds of attacks that we might be seeing are things like the seizure of this ship. Obviously, there's 25 crew members on the ship, and we don't really know. They're now being taken to Iranian-controlled waters. We don't really know what's going to happen there. But if this is the level of response, I think it's a sign from Iran that it's not interested in some sort of all-out war with Israel at this point. They're looking to probably continue building their nuclear arsenal, given that there's no Iran nuclear deal, to kind of keep it in a box. And I think maybe that could be the route they take. But obviously, we'll have to see moving forward what happens.
You mentioned, of course, the contentious relationship between Israel and the United States. And there was a pretty, I don't know, stressful phone call between President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over a week ago, talking about many things, but also humanitarian aid. And you reported that the Biden administration's Gaza humanitarian envoy on Wednesday warned that, quote, there is an imminent risk of famine for the majority, if not all, the 2.2 million population of Gaza. So, of course, Israel is taking huge steps to alleviate this. But what else did David Satterfield say during this virtual event hosted by the American Jewish Committee?
It was an interesting talk he gave. I think he's reportedly outgoing Gaza humanitarian envoy. They're looking for someone to replace him. So maybe given that he's on his way out, he was way more open than he might normally be. And he said, I thought there were quite a few headlines in what he was talking about. Obviously, we led with the point about famine. And Samantha Power, who's the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, the next day said famine's already happening in northern Gaza. Israel disputes this and says the conditions are not as bad as some of these aid organizations are saying, that are kind of biased against Israel, and that there's more food and water going in. And that whatever the problems are, it's because the food's not being distributed once it's in Gaza. But Satterfield said that he described the conditions in Rafah, where 1.4 million Palestinians are basically sheltering, crammed into a space that he says is a miserable place to live from a health and shelter standpoint. And that if you want to displace this many people in their current state of severe malnutrition, that it would just be simply a disaster. And you have to have a plan in place to provide medical care and food and shelter for these people before you launch any sort of invasion in Rafah, which is what Israel is pledging to do. But still, he says that there's no plan that's been actually detailed beyond this military plans, but actual civilian evacuation plans, those haven't been presented to the U.S. yet, which indicates it's not possible to do it, or that they're still working on it months after announcing this is what they want to do. It was interesting that he acknowledged that there were some improvements in recent days, the steps that Israel's taken to open additional crossings to get more aid in. We've seen an average for a few days of over 400 trucks a day going into Gaza. But that he said it didn't make up for the last 6 months of kind of a disaster that we've seen. And days and hours after he spoke, there were two convoys that were supposed to deliver aid to the north, which is the most, there are about 300,000 people there roughly, and they're the most in need of aid, and they were blocked by the IDF, according to the UN, based off of concerns over operations taking place in the area. So they were denied, and on Saturday as well, no aid convoys were able to reach the north. What I thought that one of the more interesting things he also said was that the biggest issue now, after there's so much aid that's been going in over the past week compared to previous months, was the issue of lack of trucks. That now, once the aid's in Gaza, we don't have the amount of trucks available to deliver the aid. Before, when it was only like 100 trucks going in a day, we had enough trucks to, because they have to switch. Once they get into Gaza, the shipments are taken off the trucks, offloaded, and then they're put onto additional trucks who deliver the aid. So those additional trucks that deliver the aid, there aren't enough of them. And right now the UN and international community is responsible, he says, for trying to find additional trucks. They have to be approved by Israel afterwards. But basically there's this scramble to try to get enough trucks into Gaza in order to distribute all this aid that's going in. And the COGAT's been publishing pictures of all this aid that's just stockpiling up in warehouses or just in open parking lots on the Gaza side of Kerem Shalom crossing that is just waiting to be delivered. And there's obviously this argument between Israel and the UN over who's responsible for the lack of aid being delivered. So there were other interesting things that Satterfield said. I'd encourage our readers to take a look at the story. But those were I think, most noteworthy.
There's, of course, going to be a link in the program notes. Now, also on Wednesday, former President Donald Trump said bluntly, in his way, any Jewish person who votes for a Democrat or votes for Biden should have their heads examined. Now, I know a lot of Israelis who are very grateful to Trump for everything he did during his tenure. And I was actually just at Trump Square yesterday in Jerusalem. Jacob, have you ever been there?
Gotta say, where is that?
That is right outside the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. Now, it's true that there is a contentious relationship in the United States between most of the Jewish electorate and Trump. But do you think these statements would sway anyone one way or the other?
No, I don't think these statements sway anyone. Those who are comfortable voting for Trump before are not going to be shaken by various statements that he makes. I think maybe this was different in terms of the shock effect of calling people to get their heads examined. But he said these kinds of statements multiple times and over the years that he doesn't understand how Jewish people vote Democrat. This was just a new formation of that argument. I think it is interesting how there might be a sliver of Jews who were very touched by Biden's support for Israel in the beginning of the war, who are becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the criticism he's been giving of Israel in the recent weeks and months, that may be swayed to go back to Trump if they weren't already there. But I think overall the lines are clearly drawn. We have roughly 75% or so of Jews who typically vote Democrat, and that's not going to be changing drastically. And it's just interesting to note, though, that also the differences between Trump and Biden on this war are not that clearly big. Trump on Wednesday, as you said, talked about how Biden was, quote unquote, abandoning Israel. But this came days after Trump called on Israel to finish the job quickly, that it's losing the PR war. He criticized how they're prosecuting the war. Too many people are dying, he said, and really criticized the videos that he says the IDF is putting out every night on Fox News that show buildings being blown up by the military. I mean, he thought that that's really not an effective way to prosecute the war. And this comes towards the right after October 7th, when Biden was really being heralded as someone who was supporting Israel. Trump, in the meantime, was criticizing Netanyahu, making fun of, still, he's still mad at him for congratulating Biden after winning in 2020. And they'll call, Trump called Defense Minister Yoav Gallant a jerk and just mocked Israel for failing to anticipate the October 7th onslaught. So there might not be the largest difference between the two, at least in terms of rhetoric and what they're saying. We'll have to, obviously, it's hard to judge Trump in terms of actions that are during the war because he's not currently in power. But if you just go based off of rhetoric, there might not be as big of a gap as people might assume.
Maybe not what they're saying, but definitely the way they're saying it.
Yes.
Jacob, thank you so much for your insights and updates today.
Thanks for having me, Amanda. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. If you have any questions or comments, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. This episode was produced by the Podwaves. Until tomorrow, shalom.